G'day, Oz, wherever you're listening, Dallas and Wuhan and in hospital, all over. You can tell the seasons are changing because mangoes have arrived in the southern markets from Darwin. The spirit, the new spirit of Tasmania, has arrived in Devonport, greeted finally by an appreciative crowd of Taswegians. Our country towns seem to be struggling, was ever thus. The view from Greenland, all that and more on a little podcast. Enjoy. G'day, this is Macca.
Hi, Macca.
Hi.
It's Jen. I'm in Liverpool Hospital and I'm desperate. Do you get many people, women calling you on Sunday mornings desperate?
Desperate women, yeah. No, Jen, yeah, what's your problem?
I'm on total bed rest. I haven't been able to get out of bed since Wednesday.
Yeah.
And I desperately need some lemon fizzy drink and some salt and vinegar chips.
Can't they get it for you in the hospital?
No.
How come?
Their staff's too busy looking after patients, apparently. There's vending machines, and I can't go to one.
Because you're bedridden?
Yeah.
Oh, look, somebody might be listening. Are you listening, Australia?
Lemon fizzy drink and lots of salt and vinegar potato chips.
Oh, sounds simple. Jen, I'll see what I can do. Look.
Look,
I'm
relying on you.
Oh, dear. Sound like Lawsy. They'd ring Lawsy and Lawsy would get it done, but I ain't Lawsy. Jen, I'll see what I can do, okay? What floor are you on, quick?
3C, room 18.
3C, room 18, okay. I'll see what I can do. No promises. Good luck. Nice to talk to you.
I hope your listeners have got a heart today.
They have, but they're in Humpty Doo and they're all over the joint. But anyway, we'll see what we can do, Jen. G'day, this is Macca. Hello.
G'day, Macca.
G'day.
How you doing?
How do I sound, Pete? Do I sound all right? Yeah.
You sound very good.
Good. That's how I am. What's happening? Where are you, Peter?
I'm in Carnarvon. I've been on the Wallaby track for a couple of months, and I'm a long-time listener, 30-plus years, a first-time caller.
Well, good on you, mate. And so you've been on the Wallaby for how long?
A couple of months. Okay. On the way to my son's wedding next weekend in Exmouth. And I've been to a lovely little place in Western Australia that I wanted to tell you about. I'm sure you know.
Mm.
It's a town called New Norcia. And it's a Benedictine town.
Yep, yeah.
They own the whole town.
Yeah, I know of New Norcia. We've talked about that from time to time over the years. And I've seen pictures. I haven't been there. I don't think I've been there.
But it's an amazing place, Macca. Mm. In fact, it has a tranquility about it. And the Benedictine monks there have, you know, the rules they live by are fantastic, and the rest of Australia could take a lesson from them. They'll take in a traveller, and they'll give you a meal, they'll give you accommodation, and they ask for nothing in return.
And that's what happened to you?
No, it didn't happen to me, but that's okay. I'm just saying that's the sort of people they are. And they have an art gallery and a museum there, and they do it in a particular Australian way. I think the settlement was established in 1847.
Wow.
When a couple of Spanish monks walked from Fremantle, the 150-odd kilometres out in the bush, and then lived with the Aborigines and hacked a village out of the scrub.
So you go. Pete, where are you from? Where you've been on the Wallaby for 3 months, did you say? Where did you travel from?
Yeah, a couple. From the border, Mwoolumbah.
Uh-huh. Wow. So
about 10,000 k's.
And it's been a good trip? You've been enjoying yourself?
Absolutely fantastic. It's been a bit of a catharsis. I've even visited the place where my parents met.
Well, there you go.
Which is a tiny railway town of no people on the Indian Pacific called Tarcoola.
Yeah, been to Tarcoola. Been to Tarcoola. Lovely little place it was when we were there, but I don't think anyone's there now.
No, at the last census, before this one, the population was a duck egg.
And it's interesting about monks and religious people who I saw this little show the other day about what the wild islands of Ireland, off the coast of Ireland, and there was one particular island there where, and it's quite high, so they landed there, a bunch of, I don't know if they're monks or what religious order they were, but they built a stairway slowly all the way up the top to this, you know, might have been hundreds of metres up there, and it must have taken them years, and then they built a little village up there, and they sat there, and I don't know how they fed themselves, but they would have, the amazing things. I'll have to find out more about that.
Well, these monks of New Norcia, they became involved in Western Australian politics. They became landowners, were very practical people. There are only a couple of them, but they created this town. And it is the most tranquil place I have ever been in my life. And they had the largest museum of religious art in Australia, and they hide their light under a bushel.
Well, not anymore, Pete, not anymore. Good on you, mate. Nice to talk to you, Peter.
Yeah, good on you, Macca. You're a constant in my life, mate.
Thanks, Peter. See you, mate.
Good on you.
Bye. Thanks for your call. G'day, this is Macca.
G'day, Macca. It's Eric here from Mortlake in Victoria. How are you today?
Good, thanks, Eric. What's happening?
I just got back from 9 weeks in South Australia, and I went from Victoria, appalling highway, Princess Highway, Highway 1, into South Australia, and it was dual carriageway, well lit. The edge of the bitumen is an extra metre wide, so you don't have the edge to worry about.
Right.
Anyway, I saw three potholes while I was in the country, state.
Three.
And two of them had been filled before I got there, and the other one I actually rang the borough council because it was in water and I hit it, and they rang me back next day and said, we're onto it.
Are you a traveller, Eric, are you, or what?
Well, I've taken a trip to Lake Eyre to see the pelicans, and that was a three-week trip, and I got up there, and I just found South Australia was a bit warmer than Victoria, but the people, oh, goodness, when I was a kid at 15, and I'm well past that now, people were nice in Victoria, and the first person I spoke to in South Australia, g'day, how you going? And friendly, friendly, friendly. Right, I got up as far as Cooper Pedy and Woomera, and had a good look around. Just couldn't stop myself. Just loved it.
Well, there you go. You're back in Mortlake now.
Yeah, and I came back via Hamilton, and Dan Tan is a pretty good local member down there, and I pulled in from Cavendish to the back of Hamilton, and would you believe there's a pothole waiting for the new premier to come and pull in right on his doorstep. I haven't told Dan yet, so I'm breaking it to you first.
All right. All right. And you say you drove to what? You drove to Maree or something and went out to Lake Eyre, did you?
Well, I got caught in the major storm event.
Yeah.
And I got to Maree, and the gravel that you would normally be walking on, you sunk down to your ankles in. Your car sunk down 6 inches, and the Unidao track was closed, as I'd been advised by the hotelier. Anyway, there's a beautiful bitumen airstrip at Maree, and a wonderful company doing flights there. Young fellas, I went up in a 5-seater plane. Two of us took off at the same time, and there was couples in the back, and I was next to a pilot, and we went for 2 hours, and his knowledge was just incredible.
We should have all done that, Eric. That'd be a lovely thing to do. But
well, it still could be done. It's 2 metres of water over the whole of the area. And that is only because the water's coming in is evaporating at the same rate, whereas in 1974, the pilot said there was 6 metres over everything because the evaporation wasn't as great that year.
Who was the pilot? What was his name?
Oh, look, I'm sorry I can't tell you that. That's one thing. Climate change completely dispelled by something he told me. Huh. He said in 2018, they did a borehole and it went down 5,000 years and every flood, everything is...
You can see them. Predicted.
Yeah. No, it's predicted. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So,
there you go. All right.
So the Aboriginal Four Seasons, our brogas know where to nest each year because of their insight for some, I don't know how they do it, but the same.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
All right, Eric, good on you, mate. Thanks for your call.
Lovely dawn here in Mortlake too this morning.
Beautiful, mate. See ya.
Bye. Have thanks for my time.
Bye. G'day, this is Macca.
G'day, Macca. It's Eric here from Mortlake in Victoria. How are you today?
Good, thanks, Eric. What's happening?
I just got back from 9 weeks in South Australia, and I went from Victoria, appalling highway, Princess Highway, Highway 1, into South Australia, and it was dual carriageway, well lit. The edge of the bitumen is an extra metre wide, so you don't have the edge to worry about.
Right.
Anyway, I saw three potholes while I was in the country, state.
Three.
And two of them had been filled before I got there, and the other one I actually rang the borough council because it was in water and I hit it, and they rang me back next day and said, we're onto it.
Are you a traveller, Eric, are you, or what?
Well, I've taken a trip to Lake Eyre to see the pelicans, and that was a three-week trip, and I got up there, and I just found South Australia was a bit warmer than Victoria, but the people, oh, goodness, when I was a kid at 15, and I'm well past that now, people were nice in Victoria, and the first person I spoke to in South Australia, g'day, here you go, and friendly, right, I got up as far as Cooper Pedy and Woomera and had a good look around, just couldn't stop myself, just loved it.
Well, there you go. You're back in Mortlake now.
Yeah, and I came back via Hamilton, and Dan Tan is a pretty good local member down there, and I pulled in from Cavendish to the back of Hamilton, and would you believe there's a pothole waiting for the new Premier to come and pull in right on his doorstep. I haven't told Dan yet, so I'm breaking it to you first.
All right. All right. And you say you drove to what? You drove to Maree or something and went out to Lake Eyre, did you?
Well, I got caught in the major storm event.
Yeah.
And I got to Maree, and the gravel that you would normally be walking on, you sunk down to your ankles in. Your car sunk down 6 inches, and the in and out of track was closed, as I'd been advised by the hotelier. Anyway, there's a beautiful bitumen airstrip at Maree, and a wonderful company doing flights there. Young fellas, I went up in a 5-seater plane. Two of us took off at the same time, and there was two couples in the back, and I was next to a pilot, and we went for 2 hours, and his knowledge was just incredible.
We should have all done that, Eric. That'd be a lovely thing to do. But
well, it still could be done. It's as 2 metres of water over the whole of the area, and that is only because the water's coming in is evaporating at the same rate, whereas in 1974 the pilot said there was 6 metres over everything because the evaporation wasn't as great that year.
Who was the pilot? What was his name?
Oh, look, I'm sorry I can't tell you that. Climate change completely dispelled by something he told me. Huh. He said in 2018, they did a borehole and it went down 5,000 years and every flood, everything is...
You can see them.
Predicted.
Yeah.
No, it's predicted. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So,
there you go. All right.
So the Aboriginal Four Seasons
Our brogas know where to nest each year because of their insights. For some, I don't know how they do it. The same.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
All right, Eric. Good on you, mate. Thanks for your call.
Lovely dawn here in Mortlake too this morning.
Beautiful, mate. See ya.
Bye. Have thanks for my time.
Bye. Edith is headed. Where are you heading to, Edith?
I'm heading to Mackay from Proserpine.
And why?
Because I'm going to the cricket, Australia versus Bangladesh, day two.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. Yeah, poor old Bangladesh. I mean, I don't know.
Oh no, they come up with their bowlers bowled beautiful yesterday. Australia's 8 down to, you know, we thought they might have got knocked out yesterday. But Starkey was good, 5 for 5 for 5.
Edith, what's your cricket story? How come you're a cricket tragic?
Well, I'm 81 now, but when I was a young mother, that's how I used to make the kids get out of my hair so I could watch the cricket. And my daughter hated cricket. And now she's in love with an umpire. So he took her 58th birthday in January, he took her to cricket, to a one-day cricket match for a birthday present, and she's mad about it now. So.
Well, it takes all kinds, doesn't it, Edith?
Yeah, it does.
So her
partner and I are taking me today.
Yeah, and did you go yesterday? Yes.
No, I've got a sick husband, so I stayed with him yesterday. He's home alone today. Oh, his sister's in the same compartment.
All right, Edith. Well, enjoy the cricket.
I will.
Yeah, and so you just sit there, or what do? You're just on your own? You just sit and what do you do?
No. Bill has booked us some chairs. We're a bit upmarket this time. Last time we went against South Africa, we were just on hard seats. But anyhow, I'm off to the cricket. So
good on you.
I love listening to you. Thanks, Macca.
Good on you, Edith. See ya. Melinda's, where are you, Melinda?
Kay Macca, I'm in Sydney at the moment.
Uh-huh, at the moment. So where are you from?
I live in Tasmania now. I've been there for 4 years, but I've popped back to Sydney to look after my aunt who's had a cancer diagnosis, and she's holed up in Hurstville Hospital. So I've had a couple of references on your show this morning, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to give you a call. There was a lady that was in Liverpool Hospital, and she was, you know, trying to have a cold lemonade and a pack of chips, and I was like, my aunt.
That's not your aunt, really, is it?
But no, she's in Hurstville, but she likes the cold lemonade, and we're writing little notes on the, you know, that you do the menu for the next day. So I'm drawing little flowers on there going, can we please have cold lemonade instead of the juice that everybody else is getting?
Oh.
And they've been giving it to us, which is really lovely.
Yeah, maybe. Look, I don't know. That's the nurses would normally do that, so maybe there's a reason why they're not giving you lemonade. I don't know.
No, it's just because we haven't asked for it directly, because we're getting it through the kitchen staff, which is more fun because we write little thank you notes on those things.
So how's things in Tassie, Melinda?
Well, Tassie is just coming out of the depths of winter at the moment. So the thing that I wanted to talk to you more about was the lady that had just spoken to you about the cricket.
Uh-huh.
That was another reference from the hospital, because I started chatting to a guy that was in the room next to my aunt. He was sort of roaming around the corridors. He was really agitated because he couldn't get in touch with his daughter to come and pick him up. And so I went and sat with him while my aunt was snoozing, had a chat, you know, like I found out that his name was Wilf. And he goes, yeah, a bit of an unusual name, Wilf. And I was like, oh, yeah, bit of an, yeah, is it, what's it short for? And he's, oh, Wilfred, tells me the origin story of his name.
Mm.
Anyway, the next day, like he was supposed to be going home that day. The next morning, he's still sitting in the corridor. Well, again, sitting in the corridor. And so I went and sat down next to him and I was like, hey, Wilf, what's going on? And he's like, oh, she's coming in today. My daughter's coming in today.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, do you mind if I sit and chat with you until she gets here or until my aunt wakes up? And it turns out that he played cricket with Richie Beno.
What was his last name?
Ewens. E-W-E-N-S.
So he probably played with Cumberland. Did he Cumberland?
Yeah. So I Googled him then.
Yeah.
I went back and Googled him, found his, you know, there was a bit of a profile thing of him, found a photo of him on Google and showed it to him. I was like, hey, Wilf, is this you? And his face
lit
up.
Isn't that a nice story?
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, Central Cumberland Cricket. That's who he'd play for. Yeah, listen, Melinda, right. I've got to fly. But,
yeah, no worries. It's so nice to talk to you, Michael.
Well, you come in here. We're here now. You better come in. My next guest, I mentioned last week, I played a little grab of my next guest, Greg Mortimer, who's a mountaineer and an Antarctician and all sorts of things. He's a traveller. And we were he mentioned Mawson's Hut and Commonwealth Bay and the big iceberg that lodged there, I think about 11 years ago or something. It lodged there all of a sudden in Commonwealth Bay, which where Mawson built his hut, and it's the place where the wind starts or the wind ends, I'm not sure, but it's very windy there, apparently. But he's a traveller, is Greg Mortimer. He's on the line. Good morning, Greg.
Hello, Mega. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you? More the point, you're back from somewhere. Where are you back from?
Yes, 5 o'clock yesterday morning, back from Greenland, East Greenland.
Did you see, isn't Donald trying to buy it or sell it or something? Donald Trump? He was.
There's a lot of talk about that amongst the locals.
I bet there is.
are they nose at the idea.
Yeah, are they wearing T-shirts saying "Don't sell us" or
whatever? Yes.
So, what were you doing in Greenland?
I was on the east coast, and there was a solar eclipse, a full solar eclipse, that passed down through Greenland.
You're not an umbrophile, are you? Or are
I'm
you?
Not an umbrophile. I might become one after seeing this.
Tell us.
I didn't know what to expect of it, never having seen one before. But we're in a very beautiful place. You know, the biggest fjord system in the world is called Scoresby Sund, and tucked up against the Greenland ice cap. And then this solar eclipse came upon us on a beautiful day, clear blue skies, and then the sky starts to go dark gradually, and it's quite eerie, and it went for about an hour. And I mean, the joy of being in we were surrounded by icebergs and big cliffs and a gorgeous place. And then all of a sudden the lights go out, and for 2 minutes 37 seconds, and then at the end of that the lights pop back on again, and there's another hour of very eerie light. And we were trying to be adjacent to the land where we could see some wildlife like muskox who are in the area to see what happened to them. Unfortunately, we couldn't see any, but it was spooky, quite moving, and, of course, otherworldly.
No, well, that's why I think that's why people who call themselves or are called umbrophiles go that, because it's otherworldly, I think, isn't it? And it makes you think how small we are and how big the universe is, and yes, it just gives you I don't know what you felt, but that's why. And they follow them. They're a bit like people who go to Bob Dylan concerts. Because I bumped into a crowd of them here. I might have been in Perth, and I talked because you talk to people. Oh yes, this is my 35th Bob Dylan concert. But they travel all over the world, and we had I met a bloke in Gundagai who runs the museum there in Gundagai, and he's one of those, and he went to, where did he go, to Mount Gambier, I think, a couple of years ago, and there's one in Sydney in 28, because they were all very disappointed that there's the Australian one is not till 2028. But he said the bad news is that after this one you get in Sydney, there won't be another one in Australia for 600 years or something like that.
But we're going to catch that one then.
Yeah, but they travel all over the world to Spain and whatever and just follow them around the world. And I suppose you've got to do something, but that's not you, Greg Mortimer.
No, not at all. No, much more sensible than that. Mm. And by golly, these people were fascinating. They were definitely, it was a boatload of umbrophiles who they're all geared up to go to a full eclipse in Egypt next year, which is that'll be quite a place to see it.
Well, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, It's something, I suppose, that you remember. But he was very dismissive of the lunar eclipses. You know, people go and see lunar eclipses. The deal is to see the full solar eclipse. That's the pièce de résistance.
Yeah, that's the bee's knees for sure.
Yeah.
It was something. And like you said, you just get a sense of us being a little dot in space, and that's quite humbling.
Greg, you went there to see that. Did you thought this is a good idea, we'll go and see that, or did you have other business in Greenland? Because you're an Antarctician. I know it's not the Antarctic, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I was leading a voyage on a ship with 120 people, and they were from all over the world. And yes, so I was running the voyage, and the solar eclipse was just part of the occasion. You know, we were there for a couple of weeks looking at in the fjords of Greenland and polar bears and muskox. And
how's Greenland doing? Because I haven't heard Donald Trump talk about Greenland of recent times, but it was all the news some time ago, wasn't it?
The people that we came across, we didn't see many people, but those that we did come across were very dismissive of the American approaches. And if you like's happened in Canada, they were quite proud of their nation, and even more so because someone else is interested in it.
Because nobody had heard of Greenland, if you know what I mean. Everyone's heard of Greenland, but you know what I mean. It's just nobody takes any notice, and all of a sudden, the Trumpster says, "Oh, I think we'll buy that." All of a sudden,
great sense of national pride. I think.
Now I played a grab of yours last week from I don't know a few years ago, and you were talking about you'd been to Mawson's Hut and Commonwealth Bay, and you told us about the big iceberg that plonked itself right in the mouth of Commonwealth Bay, and this is. When you say big icebergs, this is bigger than the Titanic, this iceberg, isn't it?
Well, it's about the size of the ACT at the moment, yeah.
And it's still there? Because I looked it up after I revisited your grab. I looked it up and it said it has shifted a little bit, but it's basically still there.
It's been stuck in and around that area for the best part of a decade. But bear in mind, it was just a tiny part of a huge much bigger piece that broke off the Ross Ice Shelf, and it ping-ponged its way around the Southern Ocean.
Isn't that amazing? Because it must weigh, probably weighs as much as the ACT as well.
Well, yes, there's a lot of gravitas in the ACT, isn't there? But yes, yes. I guess it does, although it floats. It had part of the big piece that had broken off the Ross Sea below New Zealand. That's about 2,500 kilometres away where it started its journey, broke into smaller pieces. And this ACT size one is just a bit of a cleft that's been sitting there for a decade. These are forces that are hard to get your head around.
Oh, I'll say. And imagine it just floats around and then all of a sudden goes bong and stuck there. And when I was reading, it said something about affects everything around there. It affects the ocean floor, of course, and it's just the way of the world, isn't it? I mean, I assume these things have been happening forever.
We gather they have, and it's a natural process of big ice shelves breaking up when they come into the sea. This one near Mawson's Hut, it's stuck on the bottom in about 200 metres of water, 150 metres of water. And the sea will gradually wear it down and it'll break up the crevasses in it, weaknesses, and they get broken and it breaks up. But gee, it's slow about it. It's taking a long time.
And you're lucky enough to be in there. I spoke to a bloke who was, I can't remember, it was about a month or 2 months ago, and he used to be on the, Antarctic boat, not the last one, but the one before that, that used to go down to
Antarctica.
The Dan, or, no, it doesn't matter.
No, Nella Dam was the one before, the ones before that. Yeah.
Anyway, he was the captain on that, and he said we'd go down there. And he said one of the things we'd do, we'd just be sort of coasting along and through the icebergs, past the pelicans and past the seals and whatever, just sort of almost with the engine off. And he said we'd play this classical music. Andrea Bocelli singing the Song of the Earth, and it just sounded a lovely thing. You do that all the time now, and I think it'd be great to be on that boat, because there'd be all sorts of interesting dudes on that. You know, if people are going to see solar eclipses, they're people I'd go nuts talking to people, because they'd be from all over the place. And
there's a winnowing effect that it attracts a particularly interesting group of people from all over the world. Any of these voyages to the ends of the earth. And they're fascinating with people with very great stories. And it takes a while for them to come out. You know, they're generally shy about their life stories. And some impressive people.
I'll say. Greg, next time you're following the sun, I should play that, shouldn't I? Remember the song? Follow the sun. I'll play it this morning. Next time you're over there doing something in Greenland, give us a ring. Sunday morning, Greg, it is Sunday morning, Australia time. Okay.
Well, if I get the time right, I'd love to. next year. Maybe.
You must still have jet lag, mate. So I'll let you go. But nice to talk to you.
Yeah, great. Yeah, you too.
See you, mate. Bye. This is the All Over News. It is this morning about palms. We're obsessed with palms in Australia.
Tell me about it. I hate coccus palms. I think there ought to be palm police who would have audit landscapers' designs and bloody not allow them to be put in. Those Canary Island palms, they seed profusely and they're like weeds. They grow through the bush. Whenever I walk through the bush in Sydney, I pull them out and camphor oil seedlings. I spend half my time pulling them out instead of walking.
That was Ron, and we are obsessed with palms. We put palms in everywhere. And we've got some lovely native palms, like the cabbage tree palm, but we continue to plant, as Ron said, Canary Island palms and coccus palms, and he walks through the bush and pulls them out. But it reminded me of a story I'd read and later heard on a CD from the Walkabout magazine from the 1940s. That's a long time ago. And it talks about the Afghans who came to Australia in the 1800s and brought not only their camels, but date palms. Listen to this lovely story, read by Peter Curtin, from Walkabout magazine, 1948. Walkabout magazine was Australia's first geographical magazine, went from 1934 to 1974. The particular article I refer to was written by George Farwell, and it was about the Birdsville Tract, but it tells a story about date palms and Maree 70, 80, 90, 100 years ago.
A mile or so outside Maree is a further symbol of what has passed. It is many years since Abdul Qadir died. His name is seldom remembered. Yet he initiated the only commercially successful grove of date palms in Australia. The Pizay house he built is now worn down to mud walls 4 feet high or less. Only two of the many palms remain. And propped against one of them is the stump of a ladder which Abdul used in his endless job of pollinating the dates by hand. He had planted 8 acres of them, digging an irrigation channel from a bore near the mound springs to the grove. Because the fly that pollinates the female palm does not exist in Australia, he had to do the work himself, a wearisome job that no one else would take on after he died. Hence the grove, which once produced first-class dates, has dwindled to a tattered memorial of one man's initiative and toil. Away to the northeast, a solitary camel observed us mournfully, stretching his long neck over the rail of a stockyard. Beyond, on the horizon, typically, was the mirage, a few ragged trees floating above the pale lake. The dark pyramid sandhill stood boldly etched against a hot sky. Behind us, a few old men moved about the Afghan camp. Maree will survive the extinction of its picturesque Mohammedans, for it has other resources, droving, railway freight, overland telegraph, the movement up and down the country occasioned by Flinders sheep stations, and northern cattle. Nevertheless, the Afghans and their patient camels have played a big role in the writing of its history.
Read by Peter Curtin, George Farwell writes well, doesn't he? But we don't know anything about our previous history, do we? Nothing. The Afghans played a mighty role. We still grow dates in Australia, but are very minuscule. It's a very, very labour-intensive occupation. From Andrew Lang, and we were talking about ants last week. He says, "G'day Ian, I was listening to your fun facts this morning. The one about ants not sleeping was intriguing. I'm very aware of the ants at some gateways I use on our farm. One mound at a gateway is owned by meat ants, who swarm out in warm weather when they feel some footsteps or a vehicle, but they are simply totally inactive over winter. Another mob of bull ants lives at another gatepost, and I open and shut the gate really carefully in warm weather, as the bull ant up the trouser leg is never good. I've got them at my place, but I leave them alone, and I hope they leave me alone. The bull ants just do not appear over colder weather. If they are not sleeping, what are they doing down there?" says Andrew Lang. I don't know, Andrew, but Andrew has something else on his mind. But some other facts, mainly about energy from biomass, the form of renewable energy we just have never developed here, despite it being the largest source of renewable energy consumed worldwide across the EU and in many countries elsewhere, more than all the other sources combined. It's also the lowest capital cost per megawatt of energy produced, the only one that provides all three forms of energy, power, heat and transport fuels, the one that creates the most permanent jobs, the one that is best for farmers and rural economies, and the one that is most associated with significant carbon sequestration. It also provides power on demand, but here it's one of the most obstructed by the Greens and associated bodies. In a word, we do not need nuclear, we just need to catch up on bioenergy, says Andrew Lang, to provide over 15% of our power on demand and over 30% of all energy needs. New Zealand is way ahead of us in all of this. Denmark, Austria, Sweden, Finland and several Baltic countries. And Finland, by 2040, aims to have 30% of diesel fuel and 40% of all liquid transport fuels produced from biomass. In China, says Andrew, where they lost up to half their pig population due to African swine flu, an estimated 8 million pigs, many of these dead pigs went into anaerobic digesters to produce biogas stroke biomethane, plus the byproduct digestate went to farmland as fertilizer. In Australia, when we lost 2 million plus chickens due to avian influenza, the carcasses went into pits and were buried. That's Andrew's story. More about biomass, but less about ants, sadly. This is the All Over News from Margaret Cameron. She says, September 2026 marks the centenary of when the first plant of prickly pear was destroyed in Australia by Cactoblastis cactorum. This occurred on a property on Clark's Road, 7 km southwest of Chinchilla, adjacent to the property where the insects were bred and where the Cactoblastis monument now stands. It's understandable that people today could not imagine the difficult conditions which prevailed back then and the hardships these pioneers faced. Unfortunately, there are new variants of cacti causing concern now, so a celebration of the miracle of Cactoblastis 100 years ago may assist the biosecurity department to raise awareness. And that's what's happening in Chinchilla on the weekend of the 12th and 13th of September 2026. Margaret Cameron's letter reminded me of a story I did on the All Over News 5 years ago, starting with a call from a bloke called Chris.
Hey, I just thought I'd give you a call just here on the hills, poisoning a bit of tree pear, and there was a couple of wedge-tailed eagles here, a pair of them in the tree above us, just sitting here calling out. Beautiful. They've taken flight now.
Tell people where Bowenville is.
Bowenville's between Toowoomba and Dalby on the Darling Downs.
And what are you doing this morning? You're poisoning...
Poisoning tree pear. Got a few big ones here in amongst the on the ridges, in amongst the sort of the rocky, the poorer country. Roundup and Ametrol injected into them. Mac are going around with a drill and a drill bit and drill them and just squirt it in with a
drill them and kill
little,
them.
Poison pack. That's it.
I thought I'd investigate further because I thought that the great cactus war had been run and won, but apparently not. A bloke called Terry Domico wrote the book called The Great Cactus War a couple of years ago. And he knows all about this. He spent years researching it. He's on the line this morning from Denison in WA. Good morning, Terry.
How are you doing, Ian?
As I said, I thought the Great Cactus War was run and won, but apparently that's not the case.
No. The prickly pear is actually slowly coming back in many locations due to its adaptability. The gentleman who's doing the drill and killing will find out that some of those tree pears won't die so easily.
And of course, the cactoblastis moth that we all know about in Australia, we've got even got a hall for it in chinchilla. It didn't cause the death of the great cactus, did it?
Well, it's suicide for an animal to eat all of its food source, so it didn't do that. It controlled the prickly pear and dramatically during late 1920s and 30s and basically saved Australia from becoming a third world country. I mean, it was pretty devastating for a long time. But it doesn't eat all of its food, so what does it leave behind? The nastiest tasting and the toughest eating, and so that selection with thicker skin and evolution has never stopped. So they're evolving. They're evolving mechanisms to resist cactoblastis. In fact, some of them are evolving toxins that are toxic to the caterpillars. These plants, of course, will be the ones that survive and reproduce.
I'm talking to Terry D'Amico, author of the book The Great Cactus War. Terry, what attracted you to spend five at least years of your life and write a book about this?
It's sort of serendipity, actually. It was 8 years I spent on this, believe it or not. And the story goes back to the late 1980s, and actually 1989, as you can hear from my accent, I'm an American-born Australian, as I like to say, but living in America. And as a conservation biologist, I got a contract to come over here. In 89, it was perceived on the ground that people in Australia were shooting their kangaroos to extinction. And I know that's not true, but there was a Senate subcommittee set up, and they had proposed a bill called the Muragic Bill, put sanctions on Australian imports. I was asked to come over and have a look at what was on the ground, what was really happening with the kangaroos. And I spent 3.5 years here studying the kangaroo issues and realized that there wasn't a problem, and the Muragic Bill went away. But during that time, two things happened. I fell in love with Australia, and I bumped into one day while I was out working on the kangaroo project. But that's where it started. You know, you see it everywhere out there, and eventually it just kind of took hold.
I drove out to Tara a couple of years ago, and I was amazed at the clumps of prickly pear everywhere. We haven't won the war at all, and the war still goes on, but we're losing it again?
I don't know if we're losing it yet. There's a big concern in the rangelands, because that's where most of the activity is happening, with the cactus itself. It's out of sight from the farmers and out in the open rangelands, and big areas are being infestation. And these plants, they've had 90 years of experience with a single predator, the cactoblastis moth, and they've learned ways to resist them. But they've also been sprayed with all kinds of things. Lo and behold, I heard about a big infestation up near Longreach, and I went up there, and these plants, there were two varieties. One of them's called the coral cactus, and then there's another one called the snake cactus that are infesting stations up there. They have developed resistance to all of our pesticides. When you spray them with the herbicide, they have the ability to shut off the vascular system to the outer arms, and which fall off on the ground and become propagules that can root. And so when you spray them, you shock them, and then they just simply reproduce right before your very eyes. Think you've killed one plant, and you've actually created 100. Keep an eye on them. Watch that space, as they used to say. But they have a lot of use. They're good to eat. They've been domesticated over 3,000 years. I have the domestic variety of prickly pear here in my own garden. And the pads are good to eat. In Mexico, nopalitos con huevos is the national dish. It means prickly pear pads with egg. In fact, prickly pear is on the Mexican flag. And there's medical uses for it. It's also very effective at controlling type 2 diabetes. And so there's a lot of research going on with that. And there's actually products now that are available for controlling type 2 diabetes that are extracted from prickly pear. So it may be better that we utilize this plant instead of trying to destroy it. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of it. I think we need to step back and look at this plant with a different eye to it. It's not necessarily an enemy. It might be our friend. I mean, certainly there's some places where it needs to be removed. And it, you know, this is something interesting, you know, because evolution hasn't stopped. And it's evolved here in Australia. Some of the individual lineages, some of these, what they call swarms, are so different than their parent plants that I would almost call them indigenous to Australia now.
G'day, this is Macca. Hello. Not there either.
G'day.
G'day, mate.
Andrew from Tasmania, how are you going?
Yes, Andrew, what's happening?
We're just in Devonport watching the new, the brand new Spirit of Tasmania 4 come into birth for the first time.
Oh, wow. This is the one, what, is this the one that was too long or the wharf was too short or something?
Yeah, the wharf was too short, yeah. So it's a brand new boat. It's been sitting around for 3 years, but today's the first day they've come in to test it. So,
wow. And what's it look like? Is there a big crowd there?
Oh, beautiful. Yes, yes. There's hundreds of people here in Devonport. They've put on a egg and bacon breakfast for everyone. And yeah, it's a beautiful sunny morning. It's a bit cold, but you got to expect that for Tasmania in winter.
So in the meantime, they were using the old ship, were they?
Yes, the two old ones. The old ones just come in an hour ago, and they're unloading it. And
what'll happen to them? Are they being sold overseas or something? Are they, or are they?
Oh, they'll be up for sale, I think, at the end of October.
Uh-huh. And have you been on board this new Spirit?
No one's been on it yet, no.
Wow. Well, that'll be a big deal. What sort of morning you got in Devonport?
Beautiful. Yeah, the sun's out, no wind. It's it's cold, but it's beautiful.
And I suppose that's a great relief, not only to the founding fathers of Devonport and Tasmania, but to the people generally.
Yes, yeah, everyone's here. It's a big crowd turned up for the welcoming ceremony, which is good, yeah.
So it's a much bigger boat than the old Spirit?
Yes, it's pretty much maximum length that they can have to be able to turn around in the river in here.
It
comes into dock and it's got to turn around to park and then leave again. So
there's only one of them and there's not two?
Yeah, there's two. There's number four and number five.
Uh-huh. Well, and so you get a lot of trucks and big rigs and things that need to come across, so it's got to be big,
eh? Yeah, a lot of freight, a lot of cars and caravans and passengers.
Maybe in,
so it should be good.
Maybe sometime in the future they'll have a bridge, Andrew. Well, don't laugh because, I mean, stranger things have happened, but...
yes, that's right, yes.
You never know, but... yes, Bass Strait is problematic when you're crossing some from time to time. But
yeah, it gets pretty rough in winter, in windy days and whatever.
I'll say. Well, yeah. Andrew, good on you. Thanks for your report down there. Lovely morning, and everybody's smiling, I bet.
It is, yes. Now, would I be able to say hello to my mother in Swan Hill?
No way. What's her name?
No way. Elaine.
Elaine, no way. You're not going to do that. No.
She's listened to you for 50 years.
Yes, she's listened to you forever.
All right, okay. Yeah.
How long have you been doing this now for?
Forever, yeah.
Forever, yeah.
It feels like forever. All right, mate, good on you. Nice to talk to you both. Who's that in the background?
Right, bye. See you.
Jan, his wife.
See?
My wife, Jan, yes.
She never gets a word in. Good on you, Jan. Thanks, Andrew.
We love you, Macca.
See you, bye. G'day, this is Macca.
Hello.
Yep. Who's this?
Yeah, it's Peter at Bawarana.
Hi, Pete. How you going?
Good.
What's happening?
Just listening about the cactus issue.
Mm.
And being Australians and inventive and like we all love to have a good beer, why aren't we got cactus breweries and make cactus beer?
Look, it's a very... That's a very good point, Pete. I don't know why. It seems
to be like a wasted resource.
Yeah, well, it's out there. It's not as bad as it was back in the 1920s and 30s when prickly pear was everywhere. But you heard the bloke talking about cactus. The Mexicans love it. They have cactus and eggs for breakfast, for God's sake. But I suppose you can make beer out of anything, can't you? I don't know how you'd make it, but someone had come up with a... I wonder, it'd be fairly bitter, wouldn't it? I don't know, Pete. I'm not...
Well, Mexicans make tequila from it, I think.
Do they?
Well, they're all happy.
They are. All right, well, it's a good point. Well, how's things in Bree, mate?
Yeah, good, good. The cold weather's gone, starting to get warm.
Yeah, well...
looking forward to summer and down the river and swimming and whatnot.
All right. Well, that's a good point. I don't know much about brewing. I know people brew their own beer, but they usually do it the normal way with yeast and all that sort of stuff, and they brew their own beer with following a book. But I suppose I'm sure you could use cactus.
Yeah, there must be a brewer out there with the capability somewhere.
Well, there's a beer in Mexico that's made with cactus or something. I don't know.
I don't know, but once they pay me my cactus beer royalties, we can all be happy. And then I can sit back and say, well, I love it.
Good on you, Pete. Nice to talk to you.
Yep, you too. Have a good one.
See you, mate. Bye. I don't read a lot of books anymore. I sort of don't have time to sit down with a book, and I'm not sure if I'm interested in many of the topics that you see when you see a list of the writers who will be at the Sydney Writers' Festival or the Adelaide Writers' Festival or the Sorrento Writers' Festival. And I've been spoiled a bit, I suppose, by the correspondents here. Now, they wouldn't call themselves writers, and yet when you listen to them and read them, they are writers par excellence. This letter came in years ago. It's a written letter, and of course, 30 years ago, people had time to write letters, and they had no other means anyway, so they couldn't get on the mobile, they might get on the phone, so they did write. This is from my friend, she's passed now, Chloe. What a writer. But she wasn't a writer, as I said, she was writing because she wanted to tell you something and me something, and share it with the rest of Australia, which is the idea, I suppose, of writing. Chloe Muller says this. Because she'd moved. She'd been out in the bush and she'd moved back into town because you do that after a while. After 31 years in the bush, I've finally retired to suburbia. Suburbia for her was Adelaide. And it's not too foul. I actually enjoy it very much, but the bush and desert call every so often and back I go. Recently, I found myself again standing on the glorious Golden Cliffs, stretching hundreds of miles on into WA, at Twin Rocks, at the head of the Great Australian Bight, the South Australian side of Eucla. A truly beautiful, stunning spring day, and only 30 feet below me, cavorting, cruising, careening, those wonderful, wallowing, whispering whales. 38 were said to have been there that day. At one stage, 16 mums and bubs were in the camera lens's sweep. A truly amazing, uplifting, yet humbling experience. The scientists assure us that the great southern rights are making their slow trips up and down the area to imprint the rugged cliffs on their infants' mind's eyes, so they will return year after year to repeat the great birth cycle and make the long journey from the icy Antarctic to the lonely seas of South America. Anyone watching the spectacle from those cliffs will tell you that really those whale mums are simply showing off their shiny black offspring, the calves. A truly fantastic experience. Great heads down, tails up, flapping, flipping, flopping, somersaulting, jumping, splashing, for the sheer joy of being alive. From our clifftop posse, we can hear the hissing, sighing, and the incredible singing as these huge marine creatures communicate. Communicate with each other and surely with we mere earthbound mortals, telling of the delights of their watery whale wonderland and re-establishing that long-lost trust between man and mammal. Then we're heading due north, from the sea to the flat saltbush country of the Nullarbor Plain, sprinkled liberally with collapsed dole lines often leading to enormous limestone caves, strewn with fossils of ancient seas imprinted with numerous red ochre handprints of Ice Age man reaching out from prehistory perhaps 20,000 plus years ago. On we travel to the edge of the red sandhill country, disturbing a flock of superb plains turkeys as we rattle along the stony track. They fly off in a lazy flapping motion, their heads stretched forward. The transcontinental railway line, Sydney to Perth, separates the plain from those sandhills here between Ooldeer and Cook in that straight, unswerving 300-mile stretch. What a truly fabulous year. Acres and acres of wild hops, every shade of pink, yellow cassias, high stands of purple marshmallow, carpets of white, pink and mauve daisies, nodding heads of poached egg daisies, and most exciting of all, enormous patches of green with shining red, black and maroon Sturt's desert peas, like small red-coated soldiers guarding their territory. Wouldn't have missed it for quids or whatever. And welcome to those Melbourneites, and thanks, Macca, says Chloe Muller, ex-Sejuna. And the welcome to Melbourneites was because that letter was written in about 1989 when Melbourne first joined us on the great Australian discovery tour. You see, Chloe wasn't a writer, but she was a writer. Ron's on the Hume, is that right, Ron? Hello? Is Ron not on the Hume? G'day, Ron.
How you doing, Macca?
All right. Tell us your story. Where are you? What are you doing?
I'm just going out to a village called Rye Park, which is a family property inherited from way back, and I'm pretending to be a farmer. I've got some ewes that are having lambs at the moment. I'm going to feed them. And then I'll head back home where I live these days in Wollongong to be a coal miner during the week.
Wow, you're a busy boy, Ron.
Yeah, I try to keep busy, mate. You got to do something. You got to have fun, haven't you?
Well, I suppose so. Ron, you've said you've got some ewes and they're lambing, so you need to look after them too. Have you got anything, what do they call those, alpacas or anything to look after them, or what's the story?
I'm lucky that Mum's still alive, so she gets up there and she's my alpaca, keeps an eye on things. And the dogs that muster the lambs don't like the alpacas. They don't get along, so they're actually not actually that user friendly alpacas.
Oh, really? So, Ron, what coal mine do you work at?
I work in the Illawarra. There's a few still left down there.
Mm.
500 metres underground, dark as Monday to Friday. So, we sell coal actually everywhere. It's high quality. So, keeps me very busy.
I'll bet. And do you enjoy that? Did you say 500 metres underground?
Yeah, that's correct. All the Illawarra seams about 500 metres. There's about four mines left there now.
Uh-huh.
Produce about 20,000 tonne a day. High quality sold for steel.
There's lots of coal in Australia, isn't there? I mean, I was talking to a bloke 5 or 10 years ago. I forget where I was. I was in Muswellbrook, but he was telling me about all the coal. For instance, in South Australia, along the near the Nullarbor and places like that, he says there's huge amounts of coal there too. So we're on a big coal seam all over, I think.
Well, we seem to sit on a basin, you know, where at some point it comes closer to the surface, like Newcastle, Lithgow, Wollongong. That's our basin.
Mm. And what do you do underground?
Well, you know, I've got a bit older now. I'm in mid-50s, so I've... trying to get to the surface and do the support stuff up there. I'm a fitter and turner by trade. I had to leave the property in the 1988 drought. There was just no money. And did an apprenticeship and been there ever since.
Yeah, and I suppose the money's too good. You don't want to go back full-time farming.
Oh, no. I'm throwing enough money in the hole.
So you're on the highway at the moment, are you, Ron?
Yeah, just about to turn off at Gunning. I go north at Gunning and head in towards Rye Park, the village, which is near Boorowa.
Yeah, it's nice out there. Is it dry out there? Have you had much rain out that way?
We have still got a bit of a green pick. It's short grass, but there is still the El Nino's been the conversation for everyone out this way, so they tell me it's still coming.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, yeah. Good luck, Ronnie. Nice to talk to you, mate. And thanks for your call.
You too. It's been a good morning trip listening to you all the way.
All right.
Woohoo.
Good on you, Ron. See ya. Bye. Pat's in Toowoomba. Morning, Pat.
Oh, hello, Macca. I'm a missionary sister of service, but an old one. I'm 86. But when I was younger, I used to travel out into the far west of Queensland, and we would be admiring the beautiful prickly pear fruit. They looked lovely. And I was with Sister Betty. This is probably 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And we decided on the way back home we would collect some of this beautiful fruit, and like the early pioneers, we would make jam. So we did that. We got back to our convent, and we made our beautiful prickly pear jam. It was delicious. The only problem was we spent 2 weeks after that pulling the prickles out of our fingers.
Yeah, they're horrible. It's unbelievable, isn't it? There's a place.
Yes.
There's a place near me where I live, down the road, and for years and years I've seen. And it wasn't a prickly pear, but it was one of those cacti out of the, you know, the American desert in Arizona that you used to see in movies. Huge thing. It must have been about, you know, 10 meters high, and then full of those prickles. But I just looked at it as I drove past, and then the other day, when I say the other day, about 6 months ago, somebody must have bought the house and knocked it down, and the next minute there's no cactus there anymore. But all those prickles, when they, you know, they cut them. I don't know if you heard the bloke talking about it, Terry D'Amico, about who'd written a book about the prickly pear war, which still goes on apparently because there's still a lot growing out there, Pat. You're at Toowoomba, but you go west of Tara or something and you'll find it all over the place.
That's right. That's right.
So it was nice jam, but wasn't worth the prickles.
No, and the prickles on the fruit are like fine hairs. You know, you can't even see them, but they penetrate your fingers, and they lasted a long time on our hands.
Well, they didn't get in your mouth in the jam.
Oh, no, no, no. No, that didn't. That was no problem.
Well,
we never tried that again.
No, exactly. It wasn't worth the trouble, eh?
No, no.
And how are the Missionary Sisters of Service going? How's that all going?
Oh, yes, very good. We're an ageing group, of course, but we have a wonderful spirit, and we reach out to people within our range, you know, people not too far away. I'm beyond travelling hundreds of kilometres out west, but can visit neighbours and friends, and yeah.
Everybody needs friends, especially in this era of the have a mobile phone and everybody's on their phone, and yet that's, I think, right. We're lonelier than ever, Pat.
Yes, so true.
Mm. Good on you. Nice to talk to you. I won't bother. But they're apparently, because they're a very handy thing. The Mexicans love them. They make I forget what the name. We'll have to find out the name of that. He told me, but I've forgotten the name of their breakfast thing. They have eggs and prickly pear, and then it's got the cochineal, the dye, and then you can make jam out of it. And the use is apparently for diabetes and things like that. Extracts from the pear is used in the research for treating of diabetes. So it's it's a very handy thing. That's what he said. He said, look, you know, we need to look at it again. But, you know, back in the 20s and the late 1800s and early, you couldn't move out there west of Toowoomba.
So true, yes.
Good on you, Pat.
Righto. Thanks, Mac.
Thank you. Rachel's in Bailing Up. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Macca.
Tell us a story.
It is a very frosty morning this morning, and I'm on my way to our Bailing Up Medieval Festival.
See, Ben should be there. He goes to all the festivals. That's a fair way away. You're in Bailing Up in Western Australia.
Yes.
And this is where they do jousting and all that sort of stuff, is it?
I don't think they do jousting. They do horse archery, just to up it that little bit.
And they have
a king and a queen and a whole load of sword fighting going on.
All that sort of stuff. And do they have robber barons and all those sort of things that used to be around in the medieval days?
They have an old hag that's pretty bloody scary.
Rachel, how's things in Bailing Up?
Too dry. Macca, I keep hearing all the news reports that you're having all this rain, and I'm so jealous because we have had nothing. We've had 15 millimetres where we should have had a couple of hundred.
And Bailing Up is where for the rest of Australia in WA? What, is that southwest or?
Southwest of Western Australia. Mm-hmm. We're down where the fruit grows, the fruit, the wine, the cherries, the avocados, and they're all struggling.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, send some of that rain our way, guys.
Yeah, well, it was mostly in the centre of Australia, in the territory in South Australia. So around, you know, I remember talking to Doug at Darkarula, and he said, you know, it's just been one of the best seasons ever they've had, and there's lots of water in Lake Eyre. And they usually say when there's lots of water in Lake Eyre that there's a bit of rain about, and there is a bit of rain about, but for some people are just hanging out for a bit more rain for their crop. I don't know. It sounds like the crop in WA could be problematic too.
Very, very problematic. And our grain growers in the wheat belt are also struggling. Their grain's all drying out before it's made seed head.
Wow.
So, yes, we're struggling over here.
All right, Rach. Well, enjoy the do you get dressed up in as Maid Marian or something, do you?
I'm the stallholder coordinator, so I run around with a big stick and make sure that everything runs smoothly.
So that's in baling up today, is it, in town?
Yes, it's been all weekend. It's the fourth weekend in August every year.
All right. Okay, I'll try and make it sometime.
It takes the whole village to run the event. We have 70 volunteers.
So you've got lots of jousters and not jousters, but sword fighters and... Knaves? Do you have knaves?
Yes. Oh, we have lots of knaves.
Yeah.
Priests, all sorts.
And Robin Adairs, people walking around as strolling minstrels and things like that.
Yes, strolling minstrels. Elves are everywhere this year.
All right. Nice to talk to you, Rach. Good on you.
Thank you.
See
bye.
You. Bye. Craig's in Toowoomba. Craig, what's happening?
G'day, mate. First time caller, long time listener. Thanks for the conversations over the years. It's been fabulous listening to you while I work in the garden, usually.
Good on you.
Mate, it's the International Science Week, or it's the tail end. Mm. And I just wanted to let you know we've been doing some interesting trips sort of out into western central Queensland. So I work for CSIRO, and we've got a big truck called the Mobile Mission Operations Centre. It's essentially a space truck that's used for missions launching rockets and various things, but it's only 9 months old, and it's been out on the road now. When it's not being used for that, we take it around the country and actually visit communities, tell them about space, about science, technology, engineering, maths, talk to the kids. We've travelled over 25,000K at the moment through Queensland, New South Wales and South Australia right now. And this last week, we've just been up into out as far as Boolia, which is in Western Queensland. So we started off in Toowoomba last Saturday, went up to Winton and visited the Age of Dinosaurs Museum there, had a fabulous night in the sky, watching the stars with the University of Southern Queensland, and then headed out to Boolia, saw the kids out there, talked to them about all their future things they could be doing with their career paths, and we came back to Longreach. Saw another bunch of kids and public members and community there. Day before yesterday, we were in Charleville at the Cosmos Centre there. And then we've come back to Toowoomba because tonight from 4 o'clock to probably about 9, we're going to set up in Queen's Park at Frog's Hollow along with a bunch of other activities. There's going to be... the University of Southern Queensland are going to be there with telescopes, and we're going to hook into the Mount Kent Observatory. We've got a big screen on the side of our truck, and everybody can come down and actually have a look at a night in stars.
Mate, it sounds fabulous. I remember when I was at school, one of my mates, Billy Adelaide, was mad about, dinosaurs and brontosauruses and diplodocuses, and that's to me, has continued. But now I think... probably because of Elon and the way that rockets are just going up all the time, kids are fascinated with rockets and rocketry, aren't they, too? I mean,
I was a kid, I used to think I'd have to be an astronaut or a rocket scientist to be in the space industry, and that's not the case. You know, I'm a Dolby boy, and I'm an engineer, and I've been working in the space sector now in CSIRO probably for about the last 6-7 years. There's so much going on in Australia at the moment with space space resources. Are actually really important to us.
Yeah, and we were at Woomera, and then Woomera Rocket Range we were there in the 90s because it was a 50-year reunion because I think it started in 1948, and they were still launching a few rockets there at Woomera, but that's where it sort of started in Australia, didn't it? But it's a wonderful place to launch rockets in Australia, isn't it?
When we talk to the kids, they don't realise that Australia was the third country in the world to actually launch its own satellite from its own country into space. That was back in 1967.
Wow. And it's the Mobile Mission Operations Centre. Sounds great.
That's correct. Yeah. And we're there. We run the University of Southern Queensland iLaunch Cosmos tour in the country, and we've been going around Queensland this week.
Wouldn't it be great to...
fabulous getting out to see those kids.
Oh, yeah. Science is wonderful. I used to love science. If I had a good teacher. The thing at school with me, if the teacher liked me or I liked him or her, it was okay. If not... I was waiting for lunchtime, but science is—it's just a wonderful thing, and I suppose part of this is you've got to get more kids interested in science and maths and engineering and things like that, haven't you?
We do. We're getting a good uptick in Queensland. Across the nation, there has been that drop off in kids being interested in the sciences. But I think recent stats have come out and there started to be a bit of a re-interest, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah.
The other thing, can I say, prior to this, we were out in southeast Queensland going around Roma, Chinchilla, Kingaroy and Dalby, and we spoke to 1,200 kids there. Guess how many of them knew who CSIRO was?
Yeah, well, listen, I wish I was there in Queen's Park. We did a program in Queen's Park for a couple of times. Tonight, that'd be a great place to be tonight, Craig.
So come down from 4 o'clock.
Good luck and keep in touch, Craig. We always like to know the science news, even out of Science Week. I think it should go on all the time and interest kids more in science. It'd be fantastic.
Right there with you, Macca. Thanks very much for the chat.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, mate. Good on you.
Okay, bye for now.
G'day, this is Macca.
Hey, Macca. It's sunny here. Just calling up because I'm on the way back from a little road trip at the moment, just in Murrurundi here. Me and Mum have gone up to a road trip. We've gone to Angledool, tracking down some family history. We've stopped through a couple of places. Cassilis was the first stop. Been to another few towns like Tambar Springs and everything in between.
Sounds nice. Sounds like a nice trip.
So, yeah, it's been a good journey. We haven't had much luck with the family history, but either way, it's still been nice. I've just got a few observations from the journey that I'd like to talk to you about.
Sure. Did you say your name's Sunny? Because when you said it's Sunny, and I thought, oh, well, where are you? Meaning I thought the sun was out. But
No, Sunny's my name. With a U as well, not with an O. It's with a U. So,
right.
On the trip, we've just been passing through all these towns. And first off, talking about the prickly pear earlier, I've noticed a lot of those throughout all the travels.
Yeah.
All the way northwest, almost everywhere we've passed through, I've seen them all on the side of the road and every other place we've stopped. And the second observation I had was in a lot of these small towns, I've noticed a lot of kind of boarded up shops and a lot of, you know, derelict kind of buildings. There's one tradition that our family's had over the years. We've done a lot of travels and we're always stopping into charity shops, a lot of Vinnies and things like that. It's where I get most of my clothes from. And I've just noticed that, in a lot of these small towns, they're all been closing up.
Yeah, well, if you mentioned Angledool and Cassilis and places like that, it's just the nature of things, I suppose, mate. Everybody heads to the cities, and we've had unparalleled migration to Australia in the last 10 years, and most of them go to cities. Nobody goes out to Angledool, or do they? Where else did you go to?
We did end up going up to Hebel, is where we got up to.
You're really out back there, aren't you?
Yeah. Coonabarabran was another one we stopped into. The Vinnies was shut there, which was, I think, one of the op shops was closed there. Narrabri was also another one. Just all these towns in between. I'm from the coast as well, so it's not often that I'm passing through here. I'm just in from the Sutherland Shire. I'm from Kurnell, actually. In all my years of travelling, I just haven't seen it like this, I feel like.
Strip shopping, I know a lot of those places wouldn't have big supermarkets, but, strip shopping in suburbs and stuff has gone by the by because supermarkets are there. It's a nature of change. But there's nothing better than going to a little country town that you can find that's still thriving and, you've got a whole lot of shops of all sorts of things, all sorts of – but it's everywhere. I mean – and we ought to talk about it, because I think the lifeblood of Australia is where your character is too. I mean, we all live, I live in a suburb, and suburbs have changed too remarkably, and not for the better, I think, in lots of ways. But country towns, he was the bloke said he walked into a country town today somewhere. He said, and he just thought it was wonderful, lovely, you know, time to think, time to relax. And I don't know. I don't know what the problem is, Sonny. I sort of do, but people are leaving town. Farms are being aggregated, so, you know, a farm will sell up and the bloke next door will buy it, or somebody will come in, and so there's less families, and families make a country town, and the kids go to school and all those sort of things. So I don't know. But it needs to be. I don't know how you can arrest it, but our country towns are the lifeblood of Australia, I reckon. So, so you're chasing your family history. What's your family history? Were they involved in business or something? Were they in country towns?
I think we got family history of cattle farmers. So it's mum's. It's in Casillas originally, and then. Moree, a few areas like that. So it's on mum's side. Mum's father's mother is the missing link that we're trying to chase at the moment, but we haven't had any luck thus far. But Macca, it's just these country towns are beautiful, and I'd hate to see the way things are going. I mean, my whole childhood, I spent a lot of time on the road. We were always doing family trips, popping into every skate park we could growing up.
Of course.
And I mean, that's just my fondest memories, is stopping into these towns and going to these small little charity shops and just finding out stories about the people that live in these towns. And it's been a bit of a reality shock to come back and see the way that things are going. So all I can do is just tell more people about how beautiful these places are and encourage them to pass through and maybe see what that can do.
Sonny, great to talk to you. And your mum there in the background, what's her name?
Karen.
Karen, good on you, Karen.
Nice. Mum's a long-term listener. She's called once, and
from Alice Springs
one time when she had the dogs there on a she was running on. Yeah, she was gone for runs. And speaking of running today,
we're going to talk about running now.
I've been a long-time runner.
Pass the segment over to Mum here.
Oh no, I'll let you go. But I've been running for almost my whole 61 years, but I've come to a sudden halt after the knees have given in.
Yeah.
So,
Sarah Forster with the latest from the Sydney newsroom.
Thanks, Sarah. Well, that can happen to everybody. My guests have got reasonably good knees, but you know, there's always problems. But nice to talk to you, Karen, and thanks, Sonny, for the call.
Macca.
Thank you both for calling.
Thank you. You've gone through all our generations, and thank you so much, Macca.
It's a pleasure.
Love your work.
See you. Bye.
Thanks, Macca.
Bye. We're going to talk about running now, because I don't love to run. But you just heard Sonny and his mother, who were on that a road of discovery. They've been travelling. But she said she's been running 60 years. My two guests, well, I don't know how long. Annie Boyd, I know, has been running. She's 80 now. Good morning, Annie Boyd.
G'day, Macca. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, lovely to see you again. Annie's rung us for ages, and usually when she's puffing because she's training. She's been training for various marathons. And with her is Lockie Harmer, and Lockie rang us first time, some months ago, and he was on the one it's called the Bayside Run. At the moment in Kangaroo Island, they've got the Kangaroo Island Marathon on. Next week, the Sydney Marathon. Lockie, are you going in the Sydney Marathon?
Unfortunately, I'm not going into the Sydney Marathon.
Okay.
I think I'm focusing on half marathons at the moment.
And Annie, you do marathons. Are you doing the Sydney Marathon?
No, I'm saving myself for Berlin in 4 weeks' time. So
for Berlin.
Yeah.
Now, how many of those marathons have you done? What's the big ones? The Boston, New York,
Boston,
London?
New York, Tokyo.
Tokyo, London?
Chicago.
Chicago.
Excuse me. Now, of course, Sydney. Yeah. So there are it's the big six.
Have you done them all? Or
Berlin is the one I haven't done.
And that's why you want to do it?
Yeah, well, when I retired at age 70, and I'm now 80, I made it my bucket list thing to try and run the world's six majors. There are only six then, before I turned 80. So I was on my way to do it last year. And the plane landed in Singapore, and I opened the phone, as you do. There was a message from my doctor in Sydney saying, inadvertent brain scan, we found a tumour in your brain and we don't advise that you go continue on this journey and do a marathon.
No.
So I turned around and had to come back and get the surgery, and so that blew Berlin out of the water, which was really sad because it's my big six medal run, so I'm going back to have another go at it this year.
What do you get a medal for if you do the big six, do you?
You get a special medal for the big six, yeah. Wow. Yeah. And as soon it's going to be a big nine as well, because they've added Cape Town, well, the Sydney Cape Town, and soon to be Shanghai as well.
I think I said to you when I rang you the other day to come in and talk about it, because we get lots of calls here from people like Lockie who are running, and the girl who rang, and I said, she was running somewhere, and I said, how do you go just running? She said, oh, I'm rubbish. She said, I'm rubbish. But she said, I love the cake shops along the way. We've got the best cake shops in Australia, in the world, which I don't believe for 1 minute. But pastries, that's right, pastries. But everyone's running. And only when I first started doing this program, we did it in William Street, and the City to Surf that was on started at 10. So we'd finish at 10. I'd run across the windows the other side and down, they'd stream down, you know, and there might be 5,000 or 10,000 people. Now there's 90,000, for God's sake.
That's right.
And everybody's running. And next week's the Sydney Marathon, and I won't go and get coffee. Now when the marathon's on, or the half marathon, or the City Surf, because all the roads are blocked and I get locked and I can't get back, and it's just a nonsense. So why don't they run the marathon from Sydney out to Penrith or Sydney to Wollongong or something and back? But all the streets are blocked, and so I don't go out on those days. But it's something, isn't it, Lockie? Why do you run, Lockie?
Oh, it's a good question, really. I think sometimes I ask myself that mid-run, I would say. why am I doing this? I would say number one would be fitness. It's a fitness goal to keep running, something to do. Just a motivation to get up and say that you're going to do something and then to actually go out and do it. If it's a small run or if it's a long run. I started running longer distances because of family members kind of encouraged me on and kind of inadvertently coached me through to running longer distances. I think that would be probably mostly it.
Yeah. Mm. And you said you're only going to run half marathons. Is that the story?
So I hope that that's not the entire story. I've been running seriously for probably 6 months at this point.
That's all?
That's it, yeah. So start of the year,
and
I started...
And Nanny's been running... How many years have you been running?
Well, I started when I was 68, serious running. So what, right. 12 years.
So you're only an ingenue really too, aren't you?
Oh, I'm an ingenue, yeah.
So that's 12 years. But And why did you start? Big encouragement of family members and things.
Yeah, so I had a few... I have my brother and sister-in-law are fantastic. They do the High Rocks and they do all those types of events. They're quite into their running and their athletics. They kind of encouraged me on to start doing it, and it was maybe, if I'm really honest, a little bit of a family competition between us to not that we're competing in the same events, but it is fun to touch base with them around Christmas time and family gatherings to see how we're doing and to see what everyone's up to.
I'd think that half marathons or even fun runs and things like that where you run 5 or 10 Ks are good and you finish and you can talk about it. But I reckon you'd be knackered if you did a marathon. I mean, last time I looked at marathon, I'm not into athletic times. Was it two hours and 42 minutes? It's down to about two minutes, 2 hours and 10 minutes now, isn't it?
That's
broken 2 hours.
Has it? Yeah. Well, that's a long time, but it's a long time to be running, and you and I would probably be 4 hours or 5 hours or something like that.
The rest.
And I wonder how Steve Monaghetti and our other great distance runner, because you heard, was it Heather Kell, the lady who was with Sonny's mother? Was that her name, Heather? And she said she'd been running for 60 years. And she said, I can't run anymore because my knees are gone. Now, Annie, how are your knees?
Well, they come and go, but the secret is you've got to find a physio who's a runner because there's so many strengthening exercises and so much you can do to your own physiology to build strength around the knees. Mm. I mean, I probably run – my partner David runs on bone and it hasn't stopped him, but he's learned how to handle pain. Mm. But, yeah, no, it's there's – I think a lot of people start running and they get problems with their knees and they think, oh, that's it. Well, it's not it. There's lots and lots you can do with these exercises, strengthening exercises that can build them back.
Well, that's what I'm going to do, try and strengthen my...
And it's important because it affects every other part of your life.
Yes, exactly. If you you've gone in your legs, you need to find something. Yeah, and that's why everybody's getting knees done and things like that. And hips are pretty good now. Everyone gets their hips done, but knees are pretty. I've got a mate of mine who's going in to get his knees done on Wednesday, I think. But he's not a runner. But they just give out, and I mean, I think it's a punishing thing to do to run. I don't know. But lots of people are doing it. We're a bit like the old Sparta, you know. There was Athens and Sparta, and Athens was all the artistic side. And over in Sparta, they were chucking spears and running and Thermopylae and
Well, you mentioned City to Surf, Macca, because I'm obviously really interested in older people who run, being an older person myself. In City to Surf this year, there were 28 women over 80 who completed the run. The men, there were nearly 80. Over 80. So that's a heck of a lot of octogenarian runners out there doing that course. And that's a tough run. It's a brutal course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you went to the city to surf, but you take your gig is what do you do for your photographer?
Photographer, yeah. Oh. So I was a bit late to realizing that City Surf was on. I'm kind of now catching up with all these events that are running. They're making their way to my social media feeds. But as soon as I heard it was coming on, I figured out where I wanted to be. I figured out what photo I wanted to take. And I found my little spot underneath the Coca-Cola sign, iconic in King's Cross down there, Potts Point.
Yeah.
And watched them as the first waves were being released down. Completely surreal to watch thousands of people fill in this street. It was
it's amazing, isn't it? It's almost like a thing, isn't it? Like a... Oh, we're going to run. It's something to do for the people. And the same in the Melbourne Marathon. They get lots of people in these things. And then there's these things, what do they call the triathlons? I mean, really. They're really, and they can be dangerous, I suppose. If you decide just to say, oh, I think I'll run the city to surf, and you haven't been training and things like that, dangerous thing to do.
Very, very dangerous.
Yeah, you've got to actually... So how much training, Lockie? I'm speaking to Annie Boyd, who's a musician and a composer but also a runner, and Lockie Harmer. And Lockie, how much training do you do?
So Annie and I were actually talking about this earlier off radio, and I've been doing roughly about 30Ks a week, different degrees of training. Down where I live in the Southern Shire, I've got the opportunity to run in the National Park, which is beautiful, or I can take a small trip down to the beach and run along the Cronulla Esplanade. If I'm extra adventurous, running from the National Park to the beach is quite nice on the weekend. It's ramping up a little bit now as I've got a couple of half marathons ready in the books to do, and I'm doing, I think, around 40 to 50 kilometres a week at the moment training. Some of these are 10-kilometre efforts, and on the weekend I usually try to do something closer to the 21Ks to keep my legs in shape, really.
Why don't you go to Berlin with Annie? I mean, I think that'd be a guess. You wouldn't have to stay with her. She's obviously a lot faster than you, but...
as if.
Well, you know
he'll
what I mean.
Twice as fast.
That would be great. It would be great to... And that's what people do, I think, when they go running, don't they? They go in a group and do all that sort of stuff. Yeah. It's really nice to get people together because we need that more than ever, I reckon.
Two things. Two things, Macca. Absolutely right. The thing that attracts people to these big runs is what we call the vibe, the race vibe. It's something you pick up from being with a big group of people who are all committed. You see smiles everywhere at the start, a few frowns and scowls by the end, but it's the vibe. It's the vibe, and it's community. The other thing is community. It's building communities through things like the park run movement, for example, which has just brought so many people of all sorts and sizes and shapes and abilities out of the woodwork, and finding that they can bring their dogs, they can stroll their kids in a pram, and they just all meet together every Saturday morning, usually at 8 o'clock, at a place. And they're all over Sydney now. There'd be at least, I don't know how many, more than 60 runs in Sydney now. and in Australia wide, probably about 500.
Yeah.
So it's a growth industry. But that is how I think so many people turned up to the city to surf in the older age group, because older women like myself are discovering, actually, I can run a bit and walk a bit and I can finish that 5K, and then we all go and have coffee afterwards and we chat together and I make new friends. And I have never yet gone to a park run or been in a large major run without making new friends, probably lots of them.
Well, I look around the suburbs where I live and there's no the sense of community has disappeared, and I think it comes with the times, and I think it comes with mobile phones and all that sort of stuff, and I think they're a curse. But I don't know about that because I don't run, and I was asked by a bloke to come to a walk every, and I said, mate, I'd love to come to the walk, and I'll come, but you know, I'm not going to be walking 5Ks. It's just not going to happen. But I can see that people love something to be engaged in. They love to be part of something. To me, the running thing is, you know, it's tough, but it's a wonderful thing because it's a bit of getting together, but it's also self-achievement. It's like doing your garden or planting some trees and watching them grow for, you know, and as the years go by and you see, well, I did that. And it's the same with being fit and all that. And I'll continue to, sorry.
And volunteering too. I mean, the thing about the parkrun movement is that it has a big attraction to volunteers, and you get people who have been crippled and isolated in their homes, and they discover parkrun and volunteer. They can't run for whatever reasons, but they turn up every Saturday to their local parkrun and volunteer. And so there are people out there that have got up to 500 volunteer points, which is just brilliant.
My guests this morning are runners Annie Boyd and Lockie Harmer. They run, but they have other gigs as well. The last time we probably talked to Annie was when she was heading to Alice Springs, and she'd written a symphony, a piece for the was it the opening or something? Yep. Sorry.
An opera on Olive Pink.
Olive Pink. Sort of like it's a park.
In the Olive
isn't
Pink Botanical Gardens.
Yeah.
We did it outdoors. So the garden itself was a character in the opera, essentially.
That's right. And how did that go? Good?
Well, the local people seemed to love it and got standing ovations at a few performances. We were nearly thrown off course by COVID. We had 2 years of cancellations and postponements. Mm. But somehow the cast hung in. There was all local people, nearly all local people in the cast. And they hung in and we were able to bring it off. And again, that's a lovely community builder, an opera where you get so many people involved at every level, you know, from the costume design through to the staging to lighting to the actual creative production. I mean, Lockie would know a lot about that as a photographer. It's opera brings all the arts together.
Exactly. Mm. Now, I'd say music, running makes your day now, but music makes your, remember that song, Music Makes My Day? And how long has that been going on, Annie? When did you
I started writing music when I was a tiny little girl living on Manoroo Station out in Longreach, Queensland. I just picked up a recorder and learned that, with help from my sister back in Sydney. And I just have loved music ever since. And the ABC played a large part in it because Mr. Melody Man coming on the Children's Hour and the good old Argonauts Club and all that. And I was a devotee, total devotee. And so I owe the ABC heck a lot.
Everybody does, don't they, in lots of ways.
Absolutely, yeah. And I remember listening to Kindergarten of the Air and hearing the other kids singing. And I loved hearing the other kids singing because there are other kids out there, you know. It's not just us three on this property.
So. Yeah, and you also learn about, you know, singing harmony was a real, I thought, wow, doesn't that sound good?
You
sing excitement. A third or something like that and you think, gee, doesn't that sound good? And so I've always loved doing that, but talking about the ABC, I mean, I can't believe that this program is it's just because it's the nature of the ABC, and you've got this national program where people in Longreach and wherever are listening, and they're listening in Revesby and all over the joint, and in South Yarra and all over the place, and in look at this morning, as Liverpool, Lady Ring in Liverpool Hospital in Carnarvon and Mortlake in Sydney and Sydney Markets, and then the State Forest because the Gympie Muster starts, and Proserpine, and then Barkey, and then Greg Mortimer talking about Greenland. He was in Greenland, or he's talking about Greenland, and Devonport and Brewarrina and Wuhan and the Hume Highway and Toowoomba and all over the place. So, and that's what the ABC, when it was originally started, was all about. It's a national institution, and that's what's important about it. Lockie, tell me about you. You're sort of an ingenue in running, really, aren't you? Did you say 6 months you've been doing it seriously? Sort of.
So 6 months have been. I mean, it depends on how you consider taking it seriously, but I've been putting in the miles. 6 months is where it started, and since then I've done two official half marathons so far, and yeah, that's probably about where I'm at the moment. Not sure if I'll sign up for a full marathon, but I did do quite a long training session yesterday and had the inclination to sign up for a marathon, so might find myself down doing the Shell Harbour marathon in October.
Wow, they're all over the place, aren't they? I love talking to people. Like, as I mentioned, the young lady I rang, and she rang us, and I talked to her, and I said, "How are you?" And she said, "Oh, I'm rubbish." And then you'll talk to somebody else, and I talked to this young kid about his soccer, and he says, "Oh," I said, "How do you go?" I always say that to people, and he says, "Oh, I'm decent." Where would you put yourself between rubbish and decent?
I would say I'm probably square in the middle.
In the middle,
to the lower side, maybe, possibly. But it depends on the race, really.
Yeah.
I think for the half marathon distance, I think I average quite well. For the shorter distances, I think fine as well. Untested with the marathon, so I have no comparison. 42 kilometres is unfathomable.
It's a long way,
at
isn't
this
it?
Point.
And yet, you know, we have people here, you know, and there was Cliffy Young who shuffled to Melbourne, and Yanis Kouros who did the same thing. And we've had, what was the name of the, we've had various people who have run across Australia. And what was the first bloke who said, I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm running across Australia." He said, "How come?" He says, "Because the wife asked me to paint the house." So off he went doing that. And Johnny Olsen, was it Cliff? Who was it? I forget now. But, people, and they just run across Australia, or they walk across Australia, they tow a little thing, they just get on the road. And fitness is, it's the whole thing, and I don't think we realise that it is, you know, you can talk about all sorts of medical interventions and stuff, but really being fit, and you don't have to be madly fit and run marathons, but exercise and just doing what you think is necessary is really the best medicine, apart from good food. That's what I think. Annie, so Berlin, will you ring us from Berlin? You reckon you'll go to Berlin?
It's still
locked in?
Well, it's locked in. I've locked in and paid up, so I'm
so how
I'm
long do
committed.
You take to, how long, can I ask you how long you take to do a marathon?
Well, let's put it this way. Berlin has a cutoff of 6 hours and 15 minutes, and they say it's pretty strict. I'm hoping it's not too strict, because I did the Gold Coast a few weeks back, and it took six hours and 41 minutes, so I've got to improve by at least half an hour.
How are you going to do that?
Proper nutrition. I bummed it out on Gold Coast, because when you're running for a long time, you've got to keep up your carbs, you've got to keep up, you know, you've got to keep your nutrition going, and it's a bit of an art form to it. It's medical, it's not an art form.
See, Lockie, you need to go with her. You need to go to Berlin with her and help her through the truth.
No, the crowd will help me. The crowd will bring me home.
Lovely thing. Look, I think you're both magic, and I love getting calls from runners and who are doing stuff, and a lot of the people who are decided to walk and run across Australia did it on their own. They just had a little cart and off they went, you know. No song and dance, they were just doing it. It's a wonderful thing to do. There you go. I hope you enjoyed our highlights package. If you want the full Monty, listen in every Sunday morning from 5:30 till 10 and tune into Australia. If you see me on the road, stop and say g'day. Contact me at macatracks@gmail.com. Talk to you Sunday.